in Luke 15, verses 11 through 32, where you'll find what is commonly referred to as the parable of the prodigal son. Now, I don't know what your Bible says. The one that I'll be reading from, the Bible's under your seats, calls this the parable of the lost son. But as you can see on the slide, I'm referring to this as the parable of the lost sons, plural. Whatever you call it, this is arguably one of Jesus' most famous parables, but many would argue, myself included, it might also be one of Jesus' most misunderstood parables. That's because, believe it or not, there's more than one prodigal person in this story. No, it's not that there are two prodigal sons. There are two lost sons. One of them who would rightly be referred to as a prodigal son. But it seems that there's a prodigal father in the passage as well. And if that sounds like an unexpected twist, well, you should know there's an even bigger twist than that. A guy named Tim Keller wrote an entire book that said this parable teaches us that our God is a prodigal God. Now, stay with me and I'll explain what Keller means in his book and what I mean by my title. But we're going to start by reading this familiar story, Luke 15, verses 11 through 32. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. He came near to the house and heard music and dancing. So he called one of his servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him?' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, before we get into who's prodigal in this parable, let's just set the context in which Jesus shared the parable. The parable of the lost sons is actually the last of three parables that Jesus shares in Luke 15. And you may know we talked about the other two a couple of weeks ago. You can find those on our website if you missed them. But all three of these parables are prompted because Jesus is being criticized for hanging out with the so-called wrong people. And by wrong people, I mean tax collectors and other, you know, obvious sinners, people that the folks like the Pharisees and the teachers of the law wouldn't be caught dead hanging out with. In fact, they would probably not even acknowledge they existed, except to perhaps let them know just how bad and how wrong they are. Well, Jesus, however, not only acknowledged these so-called sinners, he actually sat with them and shared meals with them, which would have been incredibly scandalous in his day. That's because in this day, in this culture, sitting down to eat with someone, sharing your table with someone, was a sign of acceptance. Well, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, it's not that Jesus necessarily approves of all of these people's behavior. It's just that Jesus sees all of these people as those who bear the image of God. And as such, he does spend time with them. And he shares meals with them so he might teach them about the amazing grace of God. Because it seems that God's grace is not just for, you know, religious insiders like the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. It's actually for all people. And of course, the surprising twist in this parable is that it might actually be those religious insiders, the Pharisees and the tax collector, and the teachers of the law, who actually need to hear this message the most. Of course, back to these three parables that Jesus shares in response to this criticism. The first two, the ones that we looked at a couple of weeks ago, are specifically about the fact that we are invited to celebrate when those who are lost are found. Today's parable, however, warns that we might be the ones who are lost, even if we're people who have, you know, found religion. In fact, Tim Keller writes in his aforementioned book that Jesus' purpose is not to warm our hearts with this story, but to shatter our categories. It seems that the target of this parable isn't the sinners that have gathered around Jesus. It seems to be the religious people who are, you know, doing everything that the Bible seems to require. And it seems that the main message in this story is that there's more than one way to be lost. Now, that said, it'd probably be a good time to talk about what the word parable or the prodigal means. Contrary to what we might think on the surface, the word prodigal doesn't mean lost. It actually means to spend recklessly. It means to spend everything that you have, which means that that term would be equally fitting for the father as it is for this younger son, even if the reasons for their spending vary pretty widely. Of course, before we get into the father's actions at the end of this parable, we should talk about this younger son's actions at the start of it. And those younger son's actions are incredibly scandalous. Not just because he blows all of his inheritance on questionable things, not just because he ends up living with pigs, which is about the vilest image that any Jew could ever imagine. Now, the most scandalous thing this son does is ask for his inheritance now. I mean, to ask for this while his father is still alive is the same thing as wishing that his father were dead. Now, in Jewish culture, the oldest son would get a double portion of the inheritance that every other child got. And in the case of this parable where there are two sons, that means the older son would get 2/3 of the estate while the younger son would get 1/3. Well, the younger son asked for 1/3 of what his father has while his father is still alive, which again is pretty much like saying, why don't you go ahead and die already? And that's what makes this father's response so shocking. In fact, it might be as shocking, maybe more shocking than what this son has requested. Now, a Middle Eastern father, traditionally, would respond to such a request that was so disrespectful with nothing. He would have sent his son away. He probably would have driven him out of the family with nothing but a beating. But what we find instead is this father, he divides up his property between his sons. Now, interestingly enough, the word property, the Greek word that's translated as property, is actually the word bios, which we get biology from. It literally means life. And so what actually happening is this son is literally telling his son, or telling his father, to tear his life apart. Which his father remarkably does. And because at this point in time, most of his wealth, if not all of it, would have been in real estate, in land holdings, the father really is having to sell 1/3 of what he owns just to support his son. And what does the son do with his newfound fortune? He blows it all. Now, Jesus doesn't tell us specifically what he spends this on. The older brother certainly hints at it. Jesus just says that he squandered it on wild living. I think it's safe to assume that he spent it on the typical vices of the day, which probably aren't that different from the vices of our day. Of course, whatever the specifics are, the younger son spends all that he has, and that's why he finds himself in dire straits when a severe famine strikes the land. The son is left with no other option but to go to work, and the only work that it seems that he can find in this distant land is to do something that would have been unthinkable in his home country. Now, he goes to take care of pigs, which were considered to be unclean by ancient Jews for obvious reasons. Now, I'm from a part of the country where people tend to get down with the swine. Like pulled pork is a way of life, right? But even there, anyone who ever goes to a pig farm thinks twice about dining with a swine. They're kind of gross and maybe delicious, but still kind of gross. Either way, God's Old Testament law strictly prohibited Jews from not just eating pork, but from hanging out with pigs, having anything to do with them. It's just that this down and out Jew seems to have no other choice than to care for pigs. It's because he has no money, and it would seem that he has no food. Did you catch that part in verse 16 that he said he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating? But no one gave him any. Now, one of the many reasons why pigs are considered to be unclean is because they eat garbage, like literally. This man wants to eat what the pigs are eating. But even though the people here who have no problem eating pigs, they still think what the pigs is eating is not fit for human consumption. And so they don't give him any. The man is starving. That's when Jesus says, somewhere in the middle of this, the younger son comes to his senses. And he decides he's going to return home. Only he knows that he can't return home as a son, but as hired help. Now, at this point in time, in this culture, some servants, typically those who were purchased as slaves, they lived on the estate and they worked on the estate. Hired servants, on the other hand, they lived in local villages and they had to commute to the estate where they used their skills to earn a wage. The son wants to be one of the latter. And the reason that he's come up with this idea of the plan is because in this culture, if you violated the community standards, it wasn't enough to just make an apology. You actually had to make restitution, particularly if it was something as grievous as dishonoring your family. The son seems to hope that he can learn some sort of trade and earn some sort of wage that he might begin to at least start paying off his debt. And I'm sure as he's crafted this plan and he's making this long journey home, again, he's in a distant land, he's probably rehearsing his speech again and again. How am I going to break this to my father? How am I going to win him over? But before he can even get home, his father comes running to him and says, "We're throwing a party." Now, is anyone else sensing a theme in Luke 15? That's three parables and that's three parties. Of course, before there's another party, there's this scandalous scene, this wild scene where the father runs out to meet his son. Now, as a general rule, older Middle Eastern men did not run. And it's not just because their knees hurt, which is why I don't run. It's because no man would like be caught dead hiking up his robe and baring his legs and running like a little child. But that's exactly what this man does. Of course, that's just one of the many surprises in this reunion. The father then asked for the best robe to be put on his son. The best robe in the house would have been the father's own robe. In other words, he's giving of himself. And as for this meal that's about to be served, meat was eaten very sparingly at this time. It was considered to be too expensive. And of course, the fattened calf would have only been served in the rarest of occasions, maybe a wedding or something like that. Certainly, it would be served an occasion where the entire village would have been invited to come out. I mean, this is a remarkable scene. Notice that this father showers his son with love before his son has done anything to turn his life around. Not only that, he seems to welcome back before his son can even, you know, share his repentance speech. Of course, that's only half the story, isn't it? There's a second son in this parable. The older son who also dishonors his father. Now, he does so by refusing to join which has to be the biggest party that this family has ever thrown. The son refuses to go in. In fact, he doesn't even go get his father himself. He sends someone else to find out what's going on. He's incredibly angry. And I'm sure maybe it's for some noble reasons. I'm sure he is ticked off at his younger brother who has dishonored his father, who has dishonored the family. I'm sure he's bothered by that. I'm sure he's also maybe running the numbers and know this little shindig is being thrown on what should be his inheritance. So let's just pause there for a minute and acknowledge the fact that I imagine that many of us can probably identify with the older brother here, right? Are there any firstborns in this room? Okay. Even if you aren't a firstborn, you can probably identify with this, right? Like, this isn't fair, right? And if you're thinking, well, no, it's not, but, you know, he should be glad that his younger brother is alive and well, that he's okay. That's fair too. But let me ask, is that how you felt towards your brothers or sisters when you're growing up? Or if you're an only child, towards some other family member? Did you always feel glad about them? I didn't. That's not the way I thought about my younger sister. And you know what? We didn't fight over things like family honor or inheritances. We fought over like who ate all the marshmallows out of the Lucky Charms or who violated the treaty, this demarcation that marked the back seat and split it equally in the car, right? Again, I think we can identify with this. This doesn't seem right. I mean, at the very least, if the person that you despise the most was being thrown a party on what should be your dime, would you go to this celebration? Would you join the party? Of course, that's just how this elder brother feels towards his sibling. Look at how he seems to feel towards his father. Look at how he talks to him. It's not with respect. I mean, he says, hey, look. As in, look, you. Now, that's not the way that you would speak to a dignified, distinguished Middle Eastern man. Which is why it's so shocking that the father doesn't rebuke his son. Instead, he replies, my son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Now, there's a lot going on in this. I mean, first of all, the father treats his son with respect. He says, my son. He doesn't say, like, who do you think you are? He says, my son, I'm willing to give you my life as well. In fact, I already have. Guess what? The word everything there on line two is once again the word bios. Like, I've given you my life. It's yours already. And of course, while the father does seem to acknowledge or not refute the fact that, yes, this party is being financed by this son's inheritance, he wants this son to join it. I mean, notice the fact that he says, we had to celebrate, not I had to celebrate. In other words, come, join the party. Let's share in this together. Of course, and we shouldn't overlook the fact that the father had to go out to meet his son, which would have been incredibly embarrassing. This would have been a huge sign of disrespect for someone who was supposed to be the master of the house and certainly the host of such a lavish party. It seems that here too, this father is demonstrating an incredible amount of humility and grace and mercy. Well, how does the older son respond to all this humility and grace and mercy? We don't know. Jesus doesn't tell us. Like, he just stops the story right there, which leaves us hanging, right? I mean, don't you want to know what happens next? I bet the Pharisees and the teachers of the law did as well. And I think this may be the point. I think Jesus may be inviting them and us to find ourselves in this story. And he seems to be suggesting that there is more than one way to be lost. We can rebel against God and alienate ourselves from him by breaking God's rules. Or it seems that we can rebel against God and be alienated from him by keeping the rules diligently. Neither matters if we don't know God or love God. And that's actually why I would say that both of these sons are lost. I mean, they both seem to reject their father's authority. They both seem to be looking for ways to get out from under it. The younger son may be more direct about it. But the elder brother shows his true colors at the end of the parable, doesn't he? Of course, more than anything, I think the father shows his true colors throughout this parable. That father is reckless in his spending, which makes him a prodigal. I mean, he gives both of his sons all that he has, his whole life. He throws a lavish party that both sons are invited to come and to partake of. It seems clear that he loves both of his boys. It just seems that one of them seems to be struggling to come to grips with how he could love both of them. At least that's how I read the end of this parable. Maybe that's because at the start of this parable, or that is at least at the start of Luke 15, where Jesus shares three parables. Remember, it's the older brothers that are the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who seem to struggle with the fact that Jesus has welcomed these younger brothers to come and to hear the good news of the kingdom. Like the elder brother in the story, it's not the sins of these religious leaders that seems to be alienating them from God. It seems to be their pride and their accomplishments and their rule-keeping and their meticulous moral record that's actually driving this wedge. It's actually what makes them lost, and it's making them unable to celebrate when someone who seems eternally lost suddenly finds themselves in the loving arms of a prodigal God. And yes, I'm calling God prodigal once again. That's because I think Tim Keller is right in his book. It's called The Prodigal God. I think he's right, that God actually does truly give us all that he has. He gives us his son Jesus, who laid down his life for us to pay for our sins. He gives us his spirit, who dwells in us and with us and who actually makes us new. And he gives us life forever in his kingdom. Friends, that is the good news in this parable. Oh, but don't miss the warning in the parable. If we don't know Jesus, we're lost. If we don't know God or love God, we're lost, no matter how religious we may be. And if we aren't able to rejoice when those who are obviously lost find their way into God's kingdom, then we might be lost. In fact, Keller writes these sobering words. He says, if our churches aren't appealing to younger brothers, they may be more full of elder brothers than we'd like to think. Now, I'm not here to call anyone out or to offer critique of this church or any church. And by the way, neither is Tim Keller. I think just reminding us to take seriously where we are and to pay attention seriously to what God is doing. And to consider that individually and collectively, that we should aspire to be, with God's help, more like the father in the story than either of the brothers. We should be willing to give all that we have so that others might actually be found. And we should celebrate the fact that lost people like us can be found. God's grace is truly amazing. Thanks be to God.